Well, welcome to the most difficult day, hour of the day. Well, it's just after lunch, so I'll try to be as easygoing as possible. And recall the our local goal. So we study the following object. We study a separate Riggs polygon of a planar analytic vector field on the plane. Assume that all vertices of this polygon are non-degenerate saddles. We introduced the first return map along this polygon, which is just going along trajectories until you cross the same line to the next time, and so we get a transformation which is denoted by gamma x goes to delta of x, and I claimed the last time the following theorem. If all saddles are non-degenerate, and of course everything is real analytic, then delta is an almost regular map. And almost regularity means that we have two conditions. One is delta, which is initially defined on R1 plus near the origin. We write it in the logarithmic chart. Z is minus logarithm x. So z goes, z is defined for real values, positive large values. And delta of z can be extended analytically from the real line, the positive real line, to a bell-shaped domain which I already had sketched. So it is a domain which is roughly as a square root. So asymptotically, the boundary of this domain is like the square root of the imaginary part of x, but it can be shifted somewhat to the right. So what is the how you should understand this domain? This domain is larger than any angle, so eventually it contains any angle, but still it is slightly smaller than the half plane. In the initial chart x, it would be something like, it will be larger than any angle, but still smaller than the half plane here, which means that, from the original positive semi-x, it can be extended like this. And second assumption, delta expands in such domain omega in a Dirac series, which means that delta of z can be associated with the series alpha z plus beta plus sum of e to minus mu z p mu of z. So this is an infinite sum ranging over a sequence of real exponents going to infinity, and alpha is a positive term, and beta is some complex constant. And the last time I proved this expandability, and the fact that delta expands, admits analytic expansion in such a form, follows simply from the fact that this is true for a formal normal form of vector fields. So if you just remain on the level of computations of writing formulas, then this is certainly true. And for because normal forms are integrable, you can simply integrate the corresponding differential equations and show that their solutions would be extendable in such form. So today we'll concentrate on the first property. And this first property is not algebraic as this one, but rather it is geometric. So, you know, you cannot hope to prove it by any number of computations. You need to draw pictures. And that's what we'll be going to do today. As I already said, there is a simple fact which can be verified by a more or less simple geometric reasoning that almost regular germs of this type form a group, so that if you have two maps, two germs actually, because we're talking about a germ of a holomorphic map near infinity, a composition of two germs is again will be a germ of the same type. Well, it's clear, for instance, if you look at the principal terms here, you would see that they would just correspond to stretching with positive coefficient. Okay, B is also real. And positive or shifting it to the right or to the left. So increasing or decreasing if you need the domain, you can, of course, guarantee that it will be indeed defined like this. Now, to show that series, formal series of such type survive after substitution one into another, it's also more or less easy exercise. I won't do it, especially in the after lunchtime. Besides, I remarked that if we have a correspondence map between two analytic arcs here, then it is real analytic, therefore expandable in a convergent power series, which in the logarithmic chart would correspond to a convergent Dulac series without the without this term and with mu's ranging over the set of naturals. So what remains to do is to verify that each correspondence map near a hyperbolic saddle is indeed belongs to this class. And as I said, I already verified the second condition because it is formal, so I will need to verify only the first one and construct by some geometric way the analytic continuation, the analytic extension of the correspondence map. And to do this, we need to use a full advantage of analyticity of this vector field. So on the real plane, when we say about saddle, we mean the following situation. Well, I again draw this famous picture, which consists of what? Of a rest point, two analytic curves passing through it, and transversal to each other. And the rest are something like non-analytic in general curves which fill the complement to the coordinate cross. What will be the complexification of this picture? How you can visualize the saddle in the complex domain? First of all, what is the differential equation in the complex domain? In the real plane, on the real plane, solutions of differential equation are curves which you know how to draw. And a lot of information we derive from the fact that there is not too much place in the plane, so that the elbow room does not allow those curves to behave too erratically. But when we complexify this situation, we get in a situation which will be in C2, which is, as everybody understands, R4. So in order to plot pictures in four dimensions, to draw pictures in four dimensions, I would have to cheat a little bit because it's, I don't know how to visualize objects in R4 too well. So what will be solutions of the differential equation in this situation? They will be holomorphic curves, that is, pieces of two-dimensional surfaces, which locally look like a family of parallel lines. So the picture of almost parallel curves here becomes something like a foliated imagine a book with pages. So surfaces like this look like pages in a book. So they're parallel, or maybe newspaper. You can bend it a little bit so those surfaces are not straight, not just blacks, but still they locally look like pages of a weekend newspaper. So how can will this face portrait be complexified? Okay, we know about at least two solutions which are analytic curves here. So after we complexify them, we will get one surface which is allegedly horizontal, but now it's two-dimensional. The other surface, the other curve should be a transversal surface, but well, here you see I don't have enough room, so I symbolically plot it like this. You should imagine two planes which intersect each other by just one point. Okay, so what will be other solutions? There will be some surfaces which actually are winding around those two separatrices. So it will be larger, you should think about a surface which goes like this, so just imagine a cylinder, an infinite surface which is rolled into an elastic cylinder which is accumulating to two directions, one vertical and the other horizontal. Why this is the situation? It's very easy to figure out. Suppose that we take a solution of this differential equation with this initial condition. This solution is starts close to the separatrix, right? So if we look at the complexified plane, it starts somewhere at this point. So this point was on the separatrix. So I started somewhere here. And by the continuous dependence on solutions of on initial conditions, you can actually continue this solution along any path on the drawn on this plane, except for the paths that go through the singular point. Because of the singularity, you have the theorem on initial on dependence on initial conditions fail. So in particular, what we can do is we can continue this solution, it should be white, along a circle on the separatrix, which goes around the singular point. So we draw this, I thought about some mnemonics, so the circle should be green because it belongs to the separatrix. But now we take an initial point somewhere near it, and then we continue, and it continues over this circle, and then arrives again over the same point. So here we do have actually the complementary complex plane, also C1, and instead of initial point, you hit the same complex transversal into by another point. So what occurs here is the following. We have a complex plane C1, 0, well, this, a small piece of this, and we have a another holonomy map, delta, which is a self-map of this guy into itself. Just take an initial value over this point, continue it along this circle, and come back again. This map is, surprise, analytic. Why? Because we obtained it by integration of a differential equation over the path that does not cross the singular point. So here is the biggest advantage which is provided to us by the complex geometry. In the real geometry, if you have a singular point, then it's a barrier for you. You cannot go through it along the real line. On the complex plane, you can always avoid a singularity. So instead of crushing this point, you can go around it and study the object which corresponds to such holonomy or monodromy. So this is such self-map. Let me just try to figure out how this self-map looks like. If we have two eigenvalues, lambda 1, okay, so the differential equation here, you may write it as y dot over x dot, y dot is lambda y, x dot is mu x plus higher order terms. By writing this equation, actually, we already did this computation, so I won't reproduce it. I just recall. Solutions of this differential equation in the linear approximation look like y is cx to lambda, where lambda plus higher order terms, where lambda is the ratio of the eigenvalues. Right? So lambda is a negative real number. What happens with y? Well, the choice of c corresponds to the choice of the initial value. What happens with the same solution after x goes full circle around the origin? So you have to do this as follows. X goes to x times 1, where 1 is the result of analytic continuation. So x to the lambda goes to x to the lambda times 1 to the lambda. But here we remember that 1 to the lambda is not 1, because lambda is in general a bad number, but it is rather e to 2 pi I lambda. So here, this means that as after one such going around, the value of y will be multiplied by this number, which is, in our case, we know that lambda is a real number, so it will be a number whose modulus is equal to 1. As a result, we see that after we go like this, we will make a rotation of the complex line in the linear approximation. So if I look at the points where the same solution, the same surface, intersects the cross section here, I would realize that it is not just one point, but rather an infinite series of points obtained by rotation from each other, almost rotation. Of course, this computation gives you only the leading approximation, but we know that it is analytic. So we have something tangent to the rotation by a angle, which is either irrational or rational. Now, if the saddle will be just linear, for instance, if lambda is irrational and we have no resonances, then this rotation will be indeed a rotation, because if you can linearize the situation, the field, then you'll also linearize this holonomy map. So it will be exactly orbit filling the circle. Just a sequence of rotations by irrational angles will be a dense set on this circle, which means that actually, if you look at every surface, every separate solution, just one solution, not many of them, it will be dense on this circle. And if lambda is rational, if we do have resonances, then still this almost rotation-like behavior persists, but you cannot be sure that it is indeed a rotation. It may be something close to a periodic rotation. Okay. You should be completely confused, because the behavior is absolutely erratic. Well, it's difficult to visualize. So what you should bear in mind thus far is that we have a situation in which the leaf itself is actually a dense surface which feels something not two-dimensional but three-dimensional in general. Of course, connected, yes. No, a leaf is by definition a connected object. Well, a leaf is a two-dimensional surface which fills some three-dimensional domain in this space. And what we see is, what we see on this real picture is actually only a tiny portion of this leaf, or only intersection with the real plane of one place, because the rest will, after the next turn, it will disappear in the complex domain, and you don't see it here. Still, we need to study the application delta, which is not the result of analytic continuation along the horizontal leaf as it was here, but rather we have to go from a neighborhood of one separatrix to the neighborhood of the other separatrix. So while on the real picture, it is very easy to explain what you mean, because, well, the curves look like hyperbolas here, and each curve intersects only once each cross-section, so there is no ambiguity in saying that, well, those two points are associated, well, in one-to-one correspondence with each other, so we have a one-to-one map. Once you complexify the situation, you are in a very awkward position, because each leaf intersects such cross-section by infinitely many points, and of course it will, if we draw the second separatrix and construct a cross-section to it here, then the same leaf will intersect this cross-section also infinitely many times. So you're not one-to-one correspondence, but infinity-to-infinity correspondence. This such a beast is what comes from the complexification of the saddle. Yet, the nice feature of the logarithmic coordinate actually results in the fact that you can avoid this multivaluedness, by what the topologists call the principle of the covering homotopy. Once you choose a fixed point here and a fixed point here on the same leaf, then you can continue analytically the holonomy map so that it will be the continuous continuation of the same branch. So once you choose one point here and one point here, you have fixed a branch of a multivalued function, and then its analytic continuation becomes a well-defined construction. Remember, our goal here is to study the domain of analytic continuation of these domains. So it's not the beast that bothers us. It's actually the principal goal of our research. So that's the beast whom we are hunting. So how do you... I reproduce the same picture again. So here are two my separatrices. I choose two cross sections. One is here. So let me draw a real axis here. Just a little bit more careful in drawing. So we do have a horizontal separatrix, the singularity, and this is the real plane, and this is complex, a real line complex plane singularity. So we have another real line which is a part of the second separatrix, and now we do have two cross sections, one here and one cross section is here. Okay, we choose a point here, a real point, then continuing solutions of our differential equation over this real line, we hit some point here. And this defines us the branch of analytic continuation. How, when we need to continue this application to the complex domain? Suppose we make a full term here and derive at some point here. Then we can define our correspondence map at this point as well, just by when we say to define the correspondence map, we just should guarantee that we remain at the same leaf. But if we remain at the same leaf while going this way, and if we remain at the same leaf by traveling this way, then still we're on the same leaf. So the map will be, which is obtained by constructing analytic continuation from here to here, is still the same branch of the same map. And this gives you a possibility. Now, what means travel here along the separatrix around the circle? This means that in the logarithmic chart, I still draw my domain omega for future reasons, that if we defined it our correspondence here, then by doing this trick, going this way, then going this way, and one turn the backward, we define our map at point 2 pi I. Traveling in the inverse direction, in the opposite direction, we can define our map at point minus 2 pi I, and so on. So once we want to extend the domain of our function in this logarithmic chart up or down, we have to make one more travel around a circle in the horizontal plane, then took the selected the initial branch of the transformation, look where we arrive, and make the equal one more travel in the backwards direction. So this construction seemingly allows you to extend this map anywhere you want to any horizontal hyperplane, to any right hyperplane. Because after all, you can always make one more turn and once again one more turn. So you don't see for the moment which are the obstructions to extending the map to the whole half plane, just for all those points like this. But still, my assertion was only about the possibility of extending to some bell-shaped domain, which means that the closer I am to infinity, the more times I can make like this. But sooner or later, I run out of my resources. So what is the resource which constrains me? Apparently, this should be, if my saddle is irrational, actually nothing like this can happen, because the analytic map z goes to z, x goes to x lambda is simply the map z goes to alpha z, where lambda z. So this is a linear map which can be indeed extended on the whole plane, not just half plane. The problems appear if we deal with resonance saddles. So the resonances not only cause us troubles here in the complicated form of the expansion, they also will trouble us here. Why? As I said, the computation of this form shows you that the holonomy map, which is the principal tool of the construction, is only in the linear approximation the rotation is only linear approximation. So if my lambda is pi over q, if my saddle is resonant, and the ratio of eigenvalues is pi over q, then this number is a root of unity. So after involving it into the qth power, you get identity, which means that the linear rotation is periodic. And so if you, instead of the map delta, we take delta to power q, then it will be a map of the form x goes to x plus something. No linear term here, or more precisely, unit linear term here. The question is, can we guarantee that this term will be absent? Unfortunately, no. In general, already quadratic term will appear here. So this means that we have an iteration of a map which is tangent to identity with a quadratic order of tangency, quadratic in general. So iterations of this sort are not stable. Are not stable because of the following observation. So if you take the absolute value of x, well, forget about the absolute value. I simply can explain you the dynamics of iterations of the map like this. So think about x plane, so x complex plane, then iterations of this form behave in the following way. It is very much like traveling by the vector field x dot is equal to x square plus higher order terms, right? Because you jump from a point x by x square. If x is very small, then it is the same as if you were driving with the velocity x square for time one. This vector field in coordinate 1 over x, which is u, becomes the equation u dot is equal to minus 1. So in the u chart, the dynamics of this map is very easy to describe. You just, excuse me, jump by 1 in the horizontal dimension. So when you return to the initial chart, your straight lines along which you jump become circles tangent to the real axis, and therefore your jumps will be as follows. You jump like this, then like this, and gradually accumulate. Iteration of points in the lower half plane is also like this. So what happens is that if we live in a small neighborhood of the origin and start iterating points, then sooner or later you get out of this neighborhood. And this is the resource that is indeed we need to save on. You cannot, in order to run this construction with iterations of holonomy, you should be able to iterate map as long as it remains in the domain in which every object is defined. Once your iterates go out of this, then simply the whole construction doesn't work anymore. So if we are taking points close enough to the separatrix, we can iterate for a longer time, but eventually we will jump out of this neighborhood and the construction must stop. The question is about the trade-off. If we start close enough, then we can iterate for longer. And what is the accurate dependence for how long you can do this? It turns out that, the number of times, suppose you are given epsilon here, you start at a circle of radius epsilon, okay, not epsilon, say r, and count how many times you need to jump until you exit the disk of radius 1. So this number will grow with r, and you can easily estimate it, how long does it take. Now, this any jump corresponds to as I said, a shift by 2 pi. So the closer you are to separatrix, the more to the right you start, the more times you are allowed to jump up or down before you quit the neighborhood in which everything goes on. And those estimates showing how many times you can do this are exactly the estimates which at the long range guarantee us the bell-shaped curve. So what is important that you can travel in this direction long enough. Okay, so this is more or less, okay, as before, I'm a little bit, I'm going to finish sooner probably. This hand waving, and well, basically there is nothing to beyond hand waving, actually proves you the first statement of this theorem. So what I didn't explain, I did not carry out the estimates showing that it's indeed a quadratic domain that I already told that the thumb rule is that you should never differentiate in public. And here is something even more than that. You should never make any difficult computations on the board. Certainly not the ones that you are not able to memorize and not able to reproduce without looking at some paper. So here I just explained the principal ideas. And the accurate estimates, which are actually not very difficult, you can find in the files that Matthias circulated. So you can actually verify that the number of times you can jump indeed varies as specified in this construction. So what I didn't prove, but actually can be relatively easy justified, is I only promised you to show that there are indeed two holomorphic invariant curves which are separatrices of a saddle. This is a well-known fact from dynamical systems which can be established by looking lots of ways to prove this exists. For instance, you can no, you cannot in 10 minutes. All the rest, the remaining ingredients of the proof are here. Once again, maybe I'll just, not to stop preliminary, I would explain why the almost regular groups, maps form a group. This is, yes, a relatively straightforward exercise. It is. So what I proved by this argument is that if you take one saddle and consider the correspondence map around the corner of this saddle, then you get an Ohm's regular map, extendable in a bell-shaped domain and expandable in the corresponding asymptotic series. Now I can briefly indicate how to prove that if you have several maps of this sort, the composition of such maps will again be a map of the same type, and therefore the theorem will be proved in full generality. So it is clear that in this group of almost regular germs, there is a normal subgroup which corresponds of affine germs. Affine are, of course, germs which are defined in a bell-shaped domain, but just 1 second. But have okay. Gen, if no, affine germs is excuse me, I messed up. Not affine. We have here a parabolic germs, which have no non-trivial affine part. So alpha is equal to 1, beta is equal to 0. So those are maps which are defined in the bell-shaped domain and expandable in a series which starts with just z plus exponentially decaying terms. This is, of course, a normal subgroup, and the quotient almost regular by parabolic is affine germs, which are simply maps of the form z goes to az plus b. So it is clear that affine maps form a group, and well, it's, so we need to study only parabolic germs. And the problem is to show that if you have two parabolic germs, then their composition will again be a parabolic germ. So it is more or less clear that any parabolic germ is defined in any such bell-shaped domain. And what is important, it will take a such bell-shaped domain into another bell-shaped domain. Well, as I said, the definition is of bell-shaped domains is as follows. Imaginary part of real part of Z is greater than C 1 plus C imaginary part of Z square plus O of 1. So this is the equation of the boundary of a bell-shaped domain. And it is clear that if you have one parabolic germ, then it differs from identity by an exponentially decaying term. So any polynomial, any boundary which is defined by polynomial conditions will be preserved. So of course the image will be not a curve like this, but still very similar. Exponentially small terms essentially mean that you can, in domains defined by semi-algebraic equations, the general shape is preserved. So there is no problem with the preservation of domains, and the domain of, if you have two parabolic domains, their composition will be again defined by some parabolic domain. So what remains is to show that such that the Dulac expansion is in fact stable by composition. This is a formal statement. So in order to prove the formal statement, we just look at what's going on. We have say one map Z plus R of Z, where R is an exponential sum like this, and we have another map Z plus R prime of Z, another such map. So we need to form a composition. So what we get when we evaluate this on this, then we have Z plus R of Z plus sum of P nu of Z plus R times E to minus nu Z okay, Z plus R. But okay. This is the result of substitution of this formula into this one. So this is the exponential part corresponding to the second map. Now, of course, this is not a legal structure of the expression, because I'm allowed to have here only pure exponents, genuine exponents, not shifted exponents like here. But then I expand any such stuff as e to minus nu z times e to minus nu r. And I will note that e to minus nu r is simply 1 plus sum of minus nu r k over k factorial, right? Just using the expression for the exponent. And of course, if r is an exponential sum of this sort, then also its finite powers will be exponential sums of this sort. So after all, I obtain a sum of polynomials in exponential powers, and because my exponents in both cases go to infinity, at any finite level you would have only finitely many terms. Just all nu's which no infinitely many nu's can interfere in such a way and result in the fact that after you collect all polynomial terms, you would get something more than just polynomial. So this observation simply shows you that the composition of parabolic germs will be again a parabolic germ, and this finally proves me the theorem in full generality. So what remains in order to establish the non-accumulation theorem, which is our goal, the next time I will explain to you a principle, which is a modified fragment Lindelöf principle, saying that a map with such two properties cannot have infinitely many zeros accumulating to infinity along the real axis. The map is defined in sufficiently large domain and grows not too fast, then it cannot have too many zeros. Okay, but this I will prove the next time. In the complex way. Suppose you have fixed a certain point here and fixed its image here. Well, for instance, just extending this solution over the real axis. Suppose you want to find the extension of the corresponding correspondence map to a point, so it was z, real, z, 2 pi I plus z. So, you can of course easily extend it analytically over a small neighborhood. That's not a big problem because everything is locally trivial. But the problem is that if you want to extend along a far away to a large domain, so for this you have to do lots of travel like this. So if you want to define the map at this point, you first go along the same leaf to a point here on this real axis. Then you find where the point on the real axis goes. Suppose you want to define the map at this point, taking a random far away from the real axis. So you know where how this map is defined on the real axis, and actually in some very small strip around it. well, smaller, triple, say, length one. So you start jumping by steps of 2 pi I down until you reach some point in this strip. In this strip, your map was already defined. So you take its value from here, and you need to return back. So you sort of travel several times along the list here, and so you need to you actually don't need to do anything more. In order to be able to define the value here, you have to take the value of the map which was defined here. But the point is that in order to be able to evaluate this this point during your trip, you should not leave the B disk in which the whole picture occurs. So you can make certain number of steps, but not too large. If you start far to the right, you are allowed to make many steps before you leave the B disk. Yes.
In fact, when you're sort of when you're jumping down until you're in this region, how do you think you don't jump over the region?
No. You initially defined your map on the real axis. Now, by a simple analytic extension, you define it, for instance, in a strip of width 1. Now, in order to be able to define your map far away from this, what you need to do is you need to iterate. Understood. I'm confusing between the local time here. So what happens if I let me talk on this picture. So if I want to on this picture, you don't see the logarithm because you don't see the logarithm because it's multivalued. So suppose that you are taking you want to define your map somewhere here. Then this means that you have first to make several trips along such circles. Just by construction. And only then you can pick the value that you already know, which was initially defined here. And to travel to the value at which to the point at which you pick the value of the extension, you travel by iterations of the map, which is a rational rotation. Yes. No. I cannot define here on this disk. I have a domain which looks like this. So it is real axis. Now, when you if I just slit my plane along this real axis, I will get a strip like this. I start here. I extend analytically to all points here. But then I would have to extend because the function is multivalued. I will have to go many turns around the origin. This is the idea of extension in the logarithmic chart. So you need to find this. So you go and go, while you are extending on the initially on the upper leaf, say, with the Riemann surface, your map, it was defined on such an interval of, say, length 1. On this, after you make the second trip, your map will be defined only on a smaller segment. And the end points of those segments on which you iterate are going down to zero. Since if they wouldn't go, then we would have been able to define the map on a half plane. But since every time you go, you arrive at a smaller segment. And the rate of decay, of decrease, convergence to zero of those endpoints is exactly the boundary of this bell-shaped domain. Yes. Initially you work in the standard coordinates, but then of course you introduce the logarithmic chart here and here because of the multivalidness.
But you describe how the map is defined
in the logarithm.
Right. By first choosing a point on the real
axis. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So your answers go around, and then you're at a new point that you're able to follow up.
Right. So suppose.
Then you then make a sort of a counter. Up on the top, or you just leave it there?
No, you do have to make a counter travel.
On the Y plane.
Yes. Yes. Otherwise, right, you are right. I forgot to say this. In some sense, yes. So you do have two holonomies. Here you have a holonomy. Z goes to e to 2 pi I t over q z plus higher order terms. And here you have another holonomy with p and q inverted because they exchange the role. And each holonomy does the following. It roughly rotates point around the origin, but gradually it converges to the origin or slowly evolves away. Now, if you have my correspondence map, okay, this might be indeed a better idea to explain. So I have two rotations, one rotation like this, another rotation like this. So if I fixed the point where it goes, then I necessarily have to send those points as well to each other because we have a conjugacy. Therefore, well, this is analytically extendable to each point. So when you make a full turn, and then you have to arrive to a new leaf on the Riemann surface. So the conjugacy, the local conjugacy between two maps of a non-simply connected domain can be lifted as a unique conjugacy on the universal covering. So that's basically, I realize that what I'm trying to explain is how to lift a homeomorphism between non-simply connected spaces to a universal cover over such spaces. This can be done in a unique way, and this comes from the fact that your map here conjugates two holomorphies, then you just have to control how far away you move on the universal covering. Yes. Right.
And you say, well, I got a map, which is defined on the segment of one. The segment is uniquely, you can therefore extend.
Right. Okay, thank you.
So I think I finished that one problem I was talking